Catskills, the show that is not psyched about partying like it's 1864. I'm Liz Winstead, and laughing her way to the oppression is my co-host, Moji Alamodale.
Today, we are talking about Arizona's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad time machine. And we look at the sneaky ways states that passed abortion ballot initiatives are proposing to ban access to care. Spoiler alert, it's all about the Benjamins, baby. And some amazing news out of Indiana, where for once, religious liberty works in our favor. What?
It's true. And we got guests straight from her hilarious new comedy special, Cis Woke Grief Slut. Comedian and veteran Conan O'Brien staff writer Lori Kilmartin is here. Plus, American University professor and abortion data scientist extraordinaire, Dr. Tracy Wheats is in the house to talk about all the junk science that's been validated to destroy abortion access and what the true answer is to restoring full bodily autonomy once and for all. We're here for it.
Let's do it. Whatever it is, let's do it.
Oh my God. But so much going on. I'm going to just say I didn't eclipse, but
I eclipsed and it was lovely. My child eclipsed. He was like, this is great. This is great. This is great. Can I look at YouTube now?
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm in Minnesota and we had cloud cover and it was not even in the path. So we had like,
nice.
We just had like a dip in daylight. It just felt like just a little bit like a sigh.
We had a partial eclipse of the sun, of the heart, partial eclipse of the heart.
Partial eclipse of the heart.
Partial eclipse of the heart. Yeah, we had like almost 90% in New York. But when you put the glasses on, it was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, those glasses are cool if you decide to get them in advance, like most people did not. Somebody should really just keep those on hand and sell them at a premium for when the eclipse comes because everybody's scrambling. And I feel like you could really black market up some eclipse glasses.
Apparently, people in Harlem were just sharing. And I was like, guys, it's still COVID.
Yeah. I mean, eye COVID, is that can you get COVID through the eyes?
I just feel like the eyes are close to the nose. And then there you are, sick again.
That's true.
But people were really, actually, I feel like in Harlem, people were really kind of communal and nice. We went to Brooklyn, but to the graveyard, to the Greenwood graveyard. And that was really cool. It was actually a really cool opportunity. And they had a bazillion glasses there. So in the future, if there's an eclipse and the Greenwood Cemetery invites you, just go there. They stocked up.
Well, fantastic. Well, I guess we should move on. But before we do, just a quick little thing. Moji and I are going to be together with a whole bunch of the AAF gang in Minneapolis, April 20th.
My home state.
Your home state. Are you claiming Minnesota now?
I was born in Maryland.
But we'll take you. April 20th and April 21st is the Twin Cities screening of No One Asked You at the Minneapolis St. Paul International Film Festival. Well, here's the bad news. The Saturday night screening is sold out, but there's a Sunday screening and we're all going to be at that at 2 p.m. But there is a really dope party Saturday night, 8 p.m. It's a fundraiser for Abortion Access Front. If you live in Minneapolis, Tricky Mickey is going to be spinning. There's going to be pizza and vegetables and sweets.
I'll be rump shaking.
Mochi's going to be rump shaking. There's going to be a whole bunch of really cool silent auction items. And you can bid on a chance to sing a duet with some of your favorite singers in Minnesota. Janie Winterbauer from the suburbs, John Munson from the Semisonic, Jeremy Messerschmidt, Tricky Mickey herself, and moi. That's right. You can bid on singing a duet with me. It's going to be disco and funk. It's going to be duets. It's going to be drinking. It's going to be hanging out with the AAF crew. All the information for getting tickets to the after party and to the Sunday afternoon screening, you can go to msfif.com and find No One Asked You, or put the link in the show notes. But join us. It's going to be fun. It's very rare that so many of us are together hanging, and we really want you to come see the film, have a drink with us after, and have a dance.
Oh my God, it's going to be really fun. Liz, let's move on to this week's steaming dump of abortion news.
The Arizona Supreme Court has upheld a draconian abortion ban from 1864, passed before Arizona became a state, before women could vote, and before medical science discovered washing your hands after you wipe your ass could prevent you from getting poop in your mouth. When the decision came down, Arizona conservatives were extra gaslighty, crying, "This is appalling," proceeded to reject a vote to repeal the ban, then headed on vacation. Arizona, the land of election deniers, and erection deniers.
Turns out glamping with Clarence Thomas and the Gensurrectionist is not the only pastime extremist impresario Leonard Leo has. The fifth horseman of the apocalypse is also puppeteering anti-abortion attorneys general to enforce every criminal penalty for accessing abortion in their states. I would say get a hobby, Lenny, but I feel like this is his hobby.
And finally, in Alabama, a 36-year-old woman was denied an abortion after discovering her pregnancy was not viable. Fluid had built up throughout the fetus, there was evidence of heart defects, and a tumor was found on the abdomen that was roughly a third of the size of its entire body. Despite all of this, the ghouls the state of Alabama put in charge of our bodies ruled since each condition by itself was survivable, it didn't meet the criteria for termination. The Alabama Crimson Tide is now officially how much hemorrhaging you must do to qualify for an abortion. And that has been your steaming news dump. And man, it was a triple flusher.
What the fuck? Liz, did she at least get out of Alabama and get the care that she needed?
She did. I think she went to Florida. But, you know, think about just the dystopian world we're living in now. As we talked about last week, the state of Florida has a 6-week ban that's going into effect in about 2.5 weeks. And so, holy shit. If this would have happened 2.5 weeks ago, somebody like this person, the closest place they could go now is Illinois, you know, or they can, when all of this is done.
But also she shouldn't have to leave Alabama. Like, let's be serious, right? Like she should be able to stay in her state and get this thing called healthcare that everyone deserves in the state that they live in.
Also, what kind of creepy panel that is obviously not made up of doctors says, you can't have your abortion because individually all the things that are wrong with your fetus might not be fully, you know, might not kill the fetus. So that's like saying, well, you know, you have melanoma and you have small liver cancer and you have throat cancer. We can treat all three of those things separately. So we're just not going to treat you at all.
Yep.
Like what?
Basically where they settled. Also, the fact that like a person has to wait for a panel to decide that they need healthcare is just appalling. And I feel like when I was younger, when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, the Republican talking points were actually like, oh, there are going to be these death panels that'll have to decide what kind of care you get. And here we are. And the Republicans brought it.
Well, and what's really creepy is it's two panels.
Right.
This person went to the first panel that screens, and that first panel said, oh my God, give this person their abortion. And it's this second panel that said, you know what? We do weird math and we're going to do everything in our power to not grant you that abortion. So we're going to create this wildly bizarre scenario that these three horrifying anomalies separately aren't as bad. So we're not going to act like this fetus has all three. I mean, I don't even understand how it works. It's terrible.
It's terrible.
Also, that death panel shit that you talked about, that was about hospice care.
Mm-hmm.
That was literally about hospice care. And they were like screaming about death panels and because they didn't want to cover hospice. So fuck these people. It's really a problem. And that story is just one of many. And Alabama gonna Alabama. And with Florida, you know, sort of out of the game now, the whole American South is just an abortion tragedy.
I feel like every 2 weeks we're talking about Alabama. Why is Alabama so thirsty? Why do they want to be on our pad so bad?
Alabama really is thirsty. They're really like, they're talking about me. I don't care how, but they're talking about me.
All press is good press. It's not Alabama. Stop it.
It's really gross. Yeah. Learn that, Alabama. All press is not good press.
Liz, let's get to the stories that we want to break down further. And this is good news. So I'm super excited.
I know. Everybody take a deep breath and an exhale because this is actually not good news. I think it's actually great news. So it's great news for a couple of reasons. So the state of Indiana just handed Mike Pence and mother their asses and the rest of us a sweet ass victory. Yep. The Indiana Court of Appeals just ruled that religious freedom also means freedom from religiously based abortion bans. Look out. So if your congregation is Saint Aborticus of Indy, guess what? You can worship as you please.
Oh, I want to join Saint Aborticus of Indy. I want that.
I feel like those would be good shirts. Saint Aborticus of Indy. Yeah. So this story, I feel like The story started right after Dobbs. Remember, if you're a regular pod listener, Indiana was the first state right after Dobbs that passed a ban on nearly all abortions. And right away, the ACLU of Indiana sued on behalf of five anonymous Jewish, Muslim, some other spiritual plaintiffs, and the group called Hoosier Jews for Choice. It's kind of a great name.
That's a great name. You know, I love this. They argued that their religious beliefs not only support, but in some situations mandate abortions that would be illegal under Indiana's ban. And this is the brilliant part. They cited RFRA. Hold up.
RFRA is the vocabulary word. So I'll lay it out for folks and then you can continue with the story. So RFRA stands for Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that basically said there can't be laws put in place that force someone's religion upon another citizen, right? And so that was like the federal take on it. And it was written by a bunch of Democrats, Ted Kennedy and Chuck Schumer. And then Mike Pence in Indiana decided to beef that up and change it out a little bit. So it really, really tilted that anybody who was Christian and felt aggrieved by somebody else's behavior was having their, you know, religion imposed upon.
Mike Pence enacted this beefed up that you talked about in Indiana. And again, it's been used pretty terribly and kind of against all the things that most of us on this podcast stand for.
Yeah, Hobby Lobby. They used it in Hobby Lobby. There was those nuns that didn't want their secular employees to be able to have birth control and their health insurance. That creepy web designer.
The one that was never asked to ever once do a website for a gay couple. Yeah, that one.
And thought HTML was like the Myers-Briggs test. She was an idiot. Yeah. And never was going to do it. Yeah. All of that. Right. So the good news is the thing that I really love is that this panel of three judges out of the Indiana Court of Appeals, who were two out of the three were Republican appointees. In fact, fun fact about the Indiana Court of Appeals, there's 15 members and half of them were nominated by Republicans and only one was nominated by Mike Pence.
And there are a lot of women. There's like seven women on that court, which is also pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. So this three panels, they were just like, look, they were not in any way, shape or form fucking around. They did not hesitate. They unambiguously said that the Supreme Court has set the stage when they overturned Roe to put abortion and these kind of rulings right in our laps. So now we're going to squarely as a state look to see how the other pieces of the Constitution and how our laws play out in Indiana.
And this was a 76-page ruling. Like they really thought it through. They combed through the text. This was not like an afterthought or something they wrote in the bathroom. Like they put the time in and they were unanimous.
And they were using Mike Pence's own words, letter of the law, in the RFRA law that is Indiana's RFRA law. And they just cited. It was interesting. And I love this. The judge that sort of wrote the opinion, her name is Leanna Weissman. And she said that pregnancy by its very nature defies simple prediction, which I think is so right. And they based sort of everything on what was presented to them that said plaintiffs presented enough evidence that their religious beliefs were burdened in the forms of altered sexual and reproductive patterns. How incredible is that?
That sounds so like vague sometimes. It's like, oh, altered sexual, what does that mean? And specifically, it meant that due to the fear that they may not be able to obtain an abortion as directed by their religious beliefs, the plaintiffs had just stopped having sex.
Yeah. Intimacy with their husbands went way down. So I like the idea that, you know what? I can't have a healthy sex life with my husband. And so that violates my religious beliefs. I am here for that.
I love that. Weissman was also really great because she essentially said that like the U.S. Supreme Court has been really clear that the exercise of religion includes performance of or abstention from physical acts that are engaged in for religious reasons, including having abortion.
I love that. I mean, like, this is really clear. And this case, hopefully, is going to go move forward to other cases.
Yes.
Because this isn't the only religious freedom case. We knew that Florida, they had a case, but then they foolishly merged their religious freedom case with the challenge to their 15-week abortion ban that was challenging whether the constitutionality of the ban. And because they merged it, I think that case went away, which is a huge bummer. Last year, we had plaintiffs on in a similar case from Kentucky who argued that their state's abortion ban violates their religious beliefs under the state's constitution and freedom law. And they say in a lawsuit, which has been removed to federal court, that Kentucky's Republican-dominated legislature imposed sectarian theology by prohibiting nearly all abortions, which I think that is really interesting. Sectarian theology.
It is. I mean, it's basically it. It's basically saying you are imposing your religious theories on all of us who may not hold the same sincerely held religious beliefs. I love that.
I do too. So, you know, it's a good case to watch because it's going to open up a whole conversation. And I think a whole legal precedent to say, if you're going to say things violate religious beliefs, then that's got to go both ways. And let's just see where that plays out, which is going to be awesome. So we won at their own game, which I like, but I know your story this week in Ohio, they are just constantly playing a game of how can we fuck the people when we know what the people want, but we don't want the people to have it.
So yeah, Ohio is basically here with the shenanigans, right? They, Ohio voters decided in November, overwhelmingly, surprisingly in some instances, to add abortion rights into their constitution. But the legislature is still full of a whole bunch of right-wing fuckers, and they have shenanigans. So this one representative, Josh Williams, has decided that he was going to write a new bill, and it would punish local governments that support abortion access by taking their money, money that they are due, and then hand that money, those taxpayer dollars, to fake clinics.
Ohio established this fund in like the 1930s or something, right? Like it was, it comes out of your tax dollars, and its purpose is to sort of give local governments part of the state tax revenue to put towards roads, EMS, sheriff departments, infrastructure, snow, trash removal, blah, parks, you know, just like helping them improve their local community.
And stabilizing communities, right? So that basically if your roads are not getting built, here's a little money from our state money that helps you kind of stabilize your government. You don't have to depend so much on like property tax revenue, et cetera.
And it's not a little bit of money.
No, it's not a little bit of money. I actually thought that it was, but it turns out, Liz, it's like $455 million.
I just don't understand the fact that they could say to a community, this thing that's legal to do, we just don't like it. So we're going to withhold your share of this honeypot. And even worse, icing on the shit cake, give it to fund abortion reversal education and fake clinics?
It's more abortion regret education, right? This $455 million is parsed out to different small, you know, towns, cities, different municipalities. And the fractions based on like, I don't remember what the thing is, but they go out to different municipalities. And they're essentially saying, if that municipality decides that they are going to put any money towards abortion support, right? Any money towards abortion travel, an organization that helps people with abortions, then that amount of money will be deducted from what they get from the community pot of tax revenues.
So wait, does that mean if I lived in a community and I ran the abortion fund there and there wasn't abortions in my community, but I was running an abortion fund, that if they found that out, that could technically jeopardize this windfall for this community?
If the state gave your abortion fund money, then this, I mean, so if you were like in Toledo and you had a fund and the city of Toledo decided to give you money for your abortion fund, then the state would say, great, Toledo, that money that you gave them, we're not giving you that money. We're deducting it from money that you would otherwise get from the state.
So basically, if a clinic took Medicaid.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
State Medicaid. Yes. Yes, if a clinic took state Medicaid, that's exactly right. And so this is, but what's wild to me is also that it would go to the, like, it would basically create a pot, and then that pot would go to fake clinics to help people with abortion regret, which is not a thing.
No, it's not a thing. You
this
know.
Is essentially, in my opinion, just another way to take taxpayer money and hand it to fake clinics. It is a payoff to fake clinics.
The short-term memory of Ohio politicians. Ohio voted in August. Like August. And then again in November. Yeah. Twice.
Yeah.
Twice in 2023, they voted to not up the threshold, to not let it be on the ballot. And then in November, overwhelmingly voted for it. So they just don't care.
Also, what's really heartbreaking about this to me is like, this is money, again, that goes to maintaining roads, maintaining bridges, maintaining basically the infrastructure that everyone in the community moves through. And they will punish that community because that community believes that people in their community have the right to healthcare. Healthcare that overwhelmingly Ohioans said, we absolutely want to be available in our state.
Just to be clear, they just introduced this bill. But when Moji and I both saw this bill, it was like, this is the beginning of shenanigans that are going to happen in all of these red states where abortion ballot initiatives look like they're going to be wildly successful or have been successful. So in finding any way to not actually enact the constitutional right to abortion, they're going to figure out ways to siphon finances or siphon anything out of the process to access care. So let this be the warning shot. We're going to be bringing more stories as more municipalities try to skirt around these issues. Just a reminder, this is the beginning.
As always, these stories will be in the show notes, and you can find the best, most up-to-the-minute resources on accessing abortion care and funding for your care on our website, aafront.org. Our Charlie chatbot on the bottom right will walk anyone anywhere in the country through their options and resources for abortion. Liz, will you introduce our first guest? Because I'm really excited to talk to her.
I will indeed. I am very excited. Our first guest is a national expert on abortion care, policy, culture, politics, and data in the United States. She's currently a professor of sociology and director of the Center on Health, Risk, and Society at American University in Washington, D.C., and she is the best. Please welcome Dr. Tracy Wheats. Tracy!
Hi!
Liz, Moji, hi!
We're so thrilled you're here because we're in a moment right now that is full of unbelievably uninformed people who want to advocate for abortion. Like the our side people are something that I just kind of want to open up with first, because research is your jam. People are your jam. Like, you are my go-to person on looking into data. We listed all of your bona fides in the intro. So as we are looking at this moment where the public is demanding full access to abortion, and the Democratic Party is landing at restore Roe, like, talk about your work in knowing what people want and why this is such a terrible position.
So thanks for having me. And it's really sad that for almost 50 years, we were given the crumbs of Roe. Right. So Roe was decided in 1973. 3 years later, we stripped public funding through the Hyde Amendment. And ever since then, it all goes downhill. And every time there's a court case, we lose something more. Oh, so teenagers need to ask their parents. Oh, you need to, you know, wait 24 hours. Oh, we need to show you your ultrasound. Oh, we need. And so, like, this is all under Roe. Right. So what we end up with right before the Dobbs decision is 800 facilities left in the country doing abortions for about a million people, people having to travel long distances, people having to, you know, not pay rent, not pay their childcare, you know, in order to beg somebody for an abortion. And then Dobbs happens, which is truly awful, right? Like, to be stripped both symbolically, to be stripped of the sense that we have any bodily autonomy, but also instrumentally in the fact that we have these 15 states where people can't get an abortion in the state. But it was not good the day before Dobbs.
Right.
It was really bad the day before Dobbs. And so to even entertain the idea that we want back that day before Dobbs, I think is a tragedy. And if you weren't paying attention during those 50 years, you might think that, oh, it's so bad today. But let's just be honest. The reason people think that it's bad today is because suddenly someone like them is on television talking about an abortion that they think is legitimate or worthy, right? Somebody who wants to be a mom, somebody who really is very, very sad. All of the things that we think justify an abortion. And I think in some ways that's why people suddenly care about abortion, is because they can imagine themselves and they can imagine someone worthy of being denied abortions. But I think the people who we denied abortions to the day before Dobbs deserve, you know, everything that they need to be able to access an abortion, have an abortion, do it in a destigmatized way. And so Roe is absolutely insufficient.
I love that you said this. And I just want to, since the Dobbs decision, there have been all these class action suits, right, to allegedly combat or clarify these bans. And in your study, when you worked with the Turnaway study, we had Diana Greene Foster here a couple weeks ago. Your study talked to the people who don't have access to the Center for Reproductive Rights, right? People who do not make good sympathetic media studies. And those are really the people we're not hearing about still.
Right.
How, based on the research you have, like, how do we help them? How do we reach out? How do we find out the information we need?
Yeah, I'm so glad you had Dr. Foster and the Turnaway study, because I always want to remind people when I'm talking to them that the Turnaway study was done under Roe.
Right.
Right. So when we talk about the harms of denying abortions and people talk about the Turnaway study, like, that is the story of Roe. Right. So that is not the story of Dobbs. Dr. Foster will write the story of Dobbs, but Turnaway is the story of Roe. And there are two things that I think are super important about that. One is that we have gestational limits under Roe, and we have gestational limits at the state level. And those limit people's ability to have abortions. And right now we are, as a, I would say, pro-choice movement, let's just call that the, like, sort of organizing for legal abortion today, reifying and re-entrenching those gestational limits into state law. We did it in Ohio, we did it in Michigan, we're going to do it in Florida, we're going to do it in Missouri. And all of those are going to recreate the Turnaway study in those states. Because despite, I mean, most abortions happen early in pregnancy, but some people need abortions later in pregnancy. And those are always the abortions that we have sacrificed in the name of some kind of social compromise. So I think that's what's important about the Turnaway study. But the other thing is that, so the folks in these lawsuits, right, the Center for Reproductive Rights lawsuits, whether it's Texas or Tennessee, these are people who have these deserving abortions, right? Like, they are sympathetic characters, they want to be moms, they demonstrate. And I did some work years ago with Katrina Kimport and Lori Friedman, and showed that we already had true disparities in who had access to those kinds of exceptions. So under viability lines, people need a doctor who agrees to do that because they think it's in the best interest of the patient, right? That it's in the health or life interest of the patient. And those abortions already were stratified, right? It was people who were high end. It was people who had relationships with doctors. It was people. So we already had a system where people were being denied abortions based on their characteristics. What's happening now is that it's applying to everybody, not just some of the people who didn't demonstrate these kinds of what we called gender maternal performances, right? Sadness, wanting to have a baby. You can't be irreverent about your abortion. You can't be like, this is actually a super good thing for me to do. You have to beg for it. And I've always said that, like, we will give abortions to the people who want them the least.
And it's that shame sword that is the most disgusting, right? And when people say life-saving abortions, they put it in this medical term of, like, literally physically dying, when anybody who wants an abortion is literally considering how their life goes forward. And it is about saving their life. And until we can shift this narrative, and we have accepted a narrative since Roe, we have accepted mm-hmm. the anti-abortion narrative. We have not required our side to self-examine anything around the social goods, the community good that abortion brings. And instead, somebody just throws out 15 weeks. It's like somebody saying, like, you know what? The color red really agitates a bull. So, well, let's just say red is really harmful and causes mental illness based on nothing, based on nothing. And then just everybody co-signing on it, right? And so until we can get to that point, and we try to do it constantly on this podcast, but it's really maddening to hear people. And a lot of times I don't even blame regular folks, because the conversations have never been allowed in spaces, in media. Nobody's kept up with like what we really should be talking about. So people have these uninformed arguments where they're trying to sound sympathetic when really they're just stigmatizing. And it really pisses me off.
I think that most people in America, what they really want is that they want the social conflict of abortion to go away. They don't actually really have an opinion about abortion. What they want is for us to stop yelling at each other and fighting and them having to drive by the bloody fetuses and, you know, somebody getting yelled at. And so they imagine that there is this magical weak compromise that we can come to that will stop the fighting. And I will be very clear. I'm never stopping the fight until everybody has an abortion that they want on their terms in a way that is, you know, accessible and affordable to them. I'm in this fight. And the other folks are in this fight. So I say, hunker down. We will get over this, but only when we accept modernity, when we accept that, you know, women deserve bodily autonomy, when we decide that anybody who gets pregnant actually gets to decide the full trajectory of that pregnancy, even if we disagree with the decisions that they make. And so we are in a struggle over the meaning and of pregnancy and control over bodies. And we're just in it.
Tracy, I'm in this fight with you. And I actually do agree that a lot of people want just the fighting to stop. But I also think that the anti-abortion movement, with the help of our media, has done an excellent job of seeding misinformation as though it's actual facts. And we say this in almost every single abortion case that's gone to the Supreme Court. We saw this in the recent mifepristone case, where basically all this junk science came from anti-abortion doctors and a dentist, right? That basically were using research that came from a biased source that was cited in the case that made it to the Supreme Court. Can you just talk about these kind of garbage studies and how this non-fact data seems to like seed the conversation around abortion in a real impactful way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the anti-abortion movement knows it can't win the argument on what they consider to be the morality, right? And they can't actually say what they really mean, which is like, they don't actually think that people who with the capacity for pregnant are equal, but you can't win that in a court. So they come up with like scientific justifications that allow them to use the apparatus of the legal system and the legislative system to restrict abortion based on these kinds of facts, because they can't actually win on the arguments that they are putting forward, because they're not majority arguments, right? We've moved on. We think women should work. We don't think people should have 13 children. We have actually evolved as a society. And because that is not their vision, they have to make stuff up. And the best way to make stuff up is to do what the merchants of doubt have done for a long time, right? Whether it was cigarettes or guns, is to make up scientific, what sounds like scientific things, and to draw on stereotypes that we all have. So the idea that like women will regret their abortion, right? We have 50 years of millions of women having abortions. We would be having an epidemic of depression if it were actually true. We would be seeing this in the general population. We're not seeing it in the general population. But it draws on the idea that they believe that every person is driven to be a mom. And the highest thing that someone could do is to sacrifice their life for their child, which is why they don't care about EMTALA, right? Because that's the role of mom, is to give her life for that child. And so they draw on that to make us think that maybe regret is real. And then it gets validated by the courts, and then bad journals, you know, publish those studies, and then those studies get cited by other bad journals. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but Everett Koop, remember him?
Oh, I do remember Everett Koop. He was in the Surgeon General back in the...
in the Reagan administration.
Reagan administration, yeah.
And Reagan asked him to go study the science about how abortion was harmful to women. And he was the last principled scientist on that side. He had written a book on anti-abortion. He was strongly anti-abortion. But he said, look, this is actually not true. This is scientifically not true. We should focus the anti-abortion movement on what we care about, which is the fetal rights. But he was the last principled guy there was. And since then, they just accepted and just spout bad, untrue things.
But as a researcher, that must be incredibly frustrating for you. Like, as a person who actually looks at the data, yeah, that just must, like, get your gullet.
I mean, it's part of why, like, Dr. Foster was so motivated to do the Turnaway study, right? Because, like, she heard, you know, Justice Kennedy say, well, while there's no reliable evidence, it seems totally fine to me that I can accept this, right? And, you know, there were several scientists who worked through the night to try to take on those mifepristone bad studies right after they came out. You know, in the end, we care. I mean, just like you care about comedy craft, we care about scientific craft. And when people do it badly, I would like to heckle these guys. Can I do
that? Throw tomatoes at them?
Did I do that? No. But it does a disservice because then the general population thinks that science can't be trusted.
Well, Tracy, I just want to point out too, for those who aren't as in the weeds as maybe we are, is that, you know, we had Roe and then we had the Planned Parenthood v. Casey mess of a Supreme Court case, which, you know, the decision was we'll uphold Roe, but we will give the states the opportunity to create abortion restrictions based on, as long as they didn't create an undue burden. And part of that was many, 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 many anti-abortion people presented amicus briefs with their abortion regret stories, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what gave Kennedy permission to say, well, look at all these people, you know, people in our side didn't do anything. And in the whole women's health case, we had so many positive stories come forward. And we've actually stepped up.
Yeah.
But one of the things I wanted to ask you is, in the research that we do from our side, the good research, the research that doesn't have an agenda, that comes out with research that is a study of things, and this is what we report. You know, one of the things that came out this year that was really interesting was that mifepristone used to be 53% of the mm-hmm. abortions that happened in America. That number shot up post-Dobbs to 63%. You and I were having a conversation and you said to me, you know, oftentimes these big institutional research outfits have to sort of go by the data they have, but there's so much other empirical things that we know that we can't quantify. Therefore, that number might be even lower. Can you talk a little bit about that 63% number that came out of Guttmacher and why that number might even be higher?
It's all about like how the measurements happen, right? So historically, we've only measured abortions in the formal healthcare system, right? So we know that people were buying drugs, you know, buying these pills on the internet. They were accessing services from an international telehealth service. So we weren't counting those at all when we were counting the 53%, right? Today, we are counting some of those other things. So the International Telehealth Service now provides services inside the United States, but we only count the ones in the formal healthcare system as the people who are getting served in states where abortion is legal or in states where abortion is not yet banned, but telehealth is legal. So that would be a state like Florida. But if those same providers are providing care to people in Texas or in, let's say, Mississippi, we wouldn't count them as in the formal healthcare system. So the decisions that researchers make that, you know, number, you know, like sort of probably smaller than it actually is. However, what is important is that the trajectory is going up and we're not off by like, you know, we're not at 90%, you know. We're not that far yet. And we're not counting it at all, the real informal sector. So we now have community-based distribution models. So where, you know, groups of community activists acquire and distribute abortion pills within their local community. We don't have any way to track those. So that might mean the number is much, much higher, or the number could be lower, because Dobbs made people really afraid that they wouldn't be able to get the abortion pills that they need. And so some people who aren't pregnant are ordering abortion pills, and we might be counting them as abortions, even though they're not using those yet. They haven't used those drugs yet. So we have a lot of noise in the system, but I think what you can take, independent of the what we would consider the noise in the system, is that a medication abortion is becoming overwhelmingly the option of choice.
Yeah.
Or necessity. Probably a little of both.
Probably a little of both. Yeah.
Yeah.
you know, we talked about a lot of stuff today. You are such a font of information. As you are looking at what's coming down the pike, what we are looking at, how we all need to shift in our advocacy to do a reset and help restore abortion access fully. That's how what I want to restore.
Yeah.
What should we be thinking about?
Abolition. I mean, we really need to think about the abolition of abortion laws. There is no reason there should be a law about abortion, right? We don't have a law about any other thing. Let's say I want to treat my cancer. I'm diagnosed with cancer. I don't believe in the medical system. I want to use vitamin C. I want to, you know, I want to pray.
Worst case.
That might be, someone might think that's a terrible decision for me. And that it's likely to end my life, but I'm perfectly allowed to do that. And there's no law that says I have to treat my cancer in a particular way. But if I'm pregnant, that what I do with my pregnancy is determined by law. And in fact, we need to imagine a full abolition of pregnancy-related laws. That's different than healthcare regulation, which says, you know, your clinician, if they're going to charge you for this service, should be, you know, licensed and should be trained. But what I get to do with pregnancy shouldn't be subject to law. And I think we are still looking for the right abortion law, and that's the wrong question.
How do we do that?
We just about, and we have Canada as a great example. So when Canada, same time, about the same time as the United States decided Roe, they would decide their abortion case and what they would choose to do rather than to offer some kind of weird set of laws is completely decriminalize it. Abortion is just not in the criminal set. It's not a matter of law. It's a matter of healthcare regulation, but that's a different thing than a matter of the criminal. And we make it a matter of the criminal code, and no pregnancy issue belongs in the criminal code.
Tracy, tell people where they can find you and where you think they can do some good in this world.
I am a professor at American University, so you can find me in the classroom. Or you can find me on Twitter, although I'm not, is it X? What do we call this now?
We dead name Twitter all the time.
Thank you. Tracy Weeds, but mostly you'll find me in the scholarly literature. And I just want to make a huge plug for AAF. I've been a big fan of the organization since its founding. I think it does incredible work. I'm working on a book right now that is trying to understand what happened to the social movement. And one of the things that we find is that we have very few activists. We have a lot of advocates. We have a lot of lawyers. We have a lot of doctors. We have a lot of people like me, scientists. We have very few activists. And AAF is one of the few activist organizations left to work, and they deserve financial and material support.
Well, thank you. I mean, who's not going to love that?
I love that.
Listen to the scientists. Dr. Tracy Weeds, thank you so much for joining us. And hopefully I will see you very, very soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Listen to the wise Dr. Weeds and be sure to support Abortion Access Front.
And now let's bring on Dukes to play Abortion or Distortion.
I'm so excited. I listened to you guys when I was away and I was like, a new game. I love a game. How are we playing it? Is it Dukes against the world? Is it who? How do we do it? Is it
it's me against you? It's me against you this time.
It's me against Liz. I'm ready. I got my mitts on.
Wow, so aggressive.
I know, so aggressive. It's the eclipse.
No, you two, I'm forcing you to be on the same team.
Oh my God, we're on a team, Moji. I feel like this is some kind of a team building exercise. I like it. So, how does the game work?
Well, this is Abortion or Distortion. This is the game where I am going to name three things and you will have to guess into which of two categories it falls under. Let's see if I can stump you this week. I'm asking you to guess if these are ancient, quote unquote, medicine or modern conservative junk science. Are you ready to play? I thought about bloodletting. It was at the top of every list.
Is there bloodletting?
I went a couple deeper cuts here. Okay. All right. So I'm going to give you three things. You're going to tell me if it's ancient medicine or modern conservative junk science. Are you ready to play abortion or distortion?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Great. Number one, is it ancient quote unquote medicine or modern conservative junk science to cure low libido in women, give them a warm, hefty dose of horse saliva?
Horse. Well, you know, here's the thing. Horse urine is used in something like some pregnancy situation that I never wanted to be pregnant. So I was never going for those kind of things. But I know that like some kind of like virgin horse urine or some shit is a thing. So I'm going to say it's ancient medicine.
Yeah, I'm backing you up with ancient medicine. That sounds bonkers.
Ancient medicine is correct. This is a cure for low libido from ancient Egypt. Yes.
Oh, did it work? How are the Egyptians doing?
You know, I feel like the Egyptians kept doing the stuff that was working, and I've never seen them running around drinking horse saliva.
Also gross.
Oh, so gross.
So much gross.
I knew that would be a fun one. Okay, so you two have 1 point. You have guessed that horse saliva was a form of ancient medicine. So number two, is it ancient medicine or modern conservative junk science? After an abortion, the cervix can become too stretched out and can lead to miscarriages, and they call it cervix incompetence.
Oh, wait.
Ancient medicine or modern conservative junk science?
So I know that not after abortion, but actually while one is pregnant, one of the many insulting ways they talk about the reproductive system of people with uteruses is an incompetent cervix. I don't know if I know that it directs to abortion per se. I'm going to say that's a no to, I'm going to say it's modern conservative junk science. That's what I'm going to say.
Modern conservative junk science. Liz, what's your thought?
Well, we have to do the same. Well, we have to agree.
Yeah, we have to agree. As I'm saying, we're talking amongst ourselves. Liz, so
I know someone who had 4 abortions and 3 kids and never talked about some flappity, flappity cervix.
She had the smartest cervix. I mean, her cervix was incompetent.
It was her cervix.
It was a Mensa cervix.
Her cervix got into their like first schools, like when it was like didn't have to go to their like you know.
It was not a safety.
No,
school
it was not a safety school cervix. So I'm gonna go with Moji and say that it's junk science by people who hate women.
That is correct. It is modern junk science. That is something someone said to someone at a fake clinic.
Or at a party.
Or a sexist doctor who was like, watch out for your floppity, flippity, floppity, flop.
Your cervix will just turn dumb and she won't be able to do it
anymore.
Yeah,
and then a judge will say, you know what? I can't grant you an abortion if you're a minor because mm-hmm. your cervix is stupid.
Because your cervix is,
stupid.
Incompetent.
Wow.
We're 2 for 2, Liz. Go us.
Yeah. Okay. All right. You guys are kicking my butt. I knew that you two would be a tough team. So I've made this last one very tricky. Are you ready? Is it ancient medicine or modern conservative junk science? The belief that a spate of profoundly inclement weather was to be blamed on people being allowed to have abortions. There was a lot of bad winter weather, and that was because people were having abortions. Is it ancient medicine or modern conservative junk science?
I feel like, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church, like that was sort of foundationally their mission. And they would always talk about like hurricanes were because of abortion and mm-hmm. butt sex, and anything bad would just be abortion and butt sex related and everything sexy,
everything but abortions.
Butt abortions are. Yeah. Yeah. Those butt abortions are bad. I have had a butt abortion. I think we all have. I think we all understand what that means if you know,
Yeah, it's what happens when you don't wash your hands.
Exactly.
Or your ass.
Or your whole hand ass. And so I'm going to say modern junk science is what I'm thinking, Moji, but what are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm with you. I agree. I feel like I've heard, that is the one that I'm definitely sure I've heard in a thing. Yeah, maybe a news report. Maybe it was the Washington Examiner.
Mm, it's entirely possible because this was said this past Wednesday. By Maine Representative LaMellon when they were talking about their abortion ban. Yeah. Well, you guys kicked my ass at this game, but it was really funny. So I think we all won.
That was super fun.
Dukes, it was so fun. I feel like I love a game where you have to think a little bit. Yeah, I like it. Dukes, thanks.
Liz, I like teaming up with you. Yeah, and Dukes, thanks for coming with the excellent questions.
Next time, I'm going to win. Have a great week.
Yes, Dukes, we'll see you next time. Moji, we're a good team.
Oh my gosh, Liz, that was so much fun.
Yeah, I mean, bring in the questions.
This was incredible as well.
Also, like, I feel like ancient science was actually science. But okay, we got to move on. And remind people that we couldn't do this podcast without the support of our fake sponsors. These days, it's easier than ever to get around in countries where you don't know the language. Just practice for a few weeks with Duolingo before your trip, and before you know it, you'll be able to say, Juan eats apples to everybody you meet.
Juan come manzanas!
But what about the language of sin? How do you express your judgment in language they can understand?
Introducing Christian Babbel, the first language app for the evangelical international traveler.
And it's so easy. Just download it, choose your target language, and Christian Babbel will teach you 100 common phrases for condemning sinners on all 7 continents.
Just shout your condemnations directly into the app, point your phone at the sinner, and let the app do the translating and the yelling. Visiting Lisbon, if you see someone walking into an abortion clinic, you have your choice of phrases like, bebe matando prostituta.
Your Uber driver in Paris is giving homosexual vibes. You can remind him that la anus est le terrain de jeu du diable.
Christian Babbel, proclaim God's retribution in any language.
That just seems like Google Translate. For Christians.
I'd love to see someone take their Christian battle to Catalan, see how that works out for them.
Also, I like the idea that it just gives you the phrases to say, so you don't even really think about what horribleness you're spitting out. It's just like, here's some horrible things. I wonder if there's like things in it like, is there a Catholic church nearby? Or is it just like, how to make people feel terrible in all languages that you can. Okay, we got to move on. The show is so long. Let's get to our next guest.
All right. Our next guest is an Emmy-nominated and WGA award-winning writer for Conan and has brought the funny to many other writers' rooms. She's also an author, comedian, parent, and certified badass. Take a listen.
My son is 13 years old now. He struggles in school. He has ADHD. Those are actually his grades. Yeah, you got 2 D's and a H. And the doctor goes, well, if you put your son on Ritalin, he'll do better in school. And I looked into it and I decided not to. I decided instead I would lower my expectations. Right? Like when he was born, I remember thinking, wow, my son could be the president of the United States one day. And now I know he could be the president of the United States. Guys, I didn't say what president. So if you're mad at me, that shit's on you.
Please welcome Lori Kilmartin. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Lor.
Ladies, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. So, Lori, I'm pretty sure that cis woke grief slut is something a dude yelled at me at a protest recently. But it's also the title of your hilarious new comedy special. So like, let's talk about the name because it seems like, it's kind of like our name, right? Feminist Buzzkills, which is holding up irony's mirror to all the aggrieved assholes who just hate that we're funnier than them. And also that we'd rather fuck a cactus than them.
Well, and they also love to get in your comments and go, Feminist Buzzkills, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually did it first. So you don't need to be your badly, weakly sarcastic self in the comments. I know people are going to call me woke, so I'll do it. And then at least I'll take that away from them and they have to become a little more creative. It's so boring. The same attitude and the same stuff you get called, especially on YouTube. I feel like that's the worst one if you are a female talking.
It's also just this inevitability of rage that you even are talking, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Like, and it took me a long time to figure this out, but I think the internet was super helpful where it's like you just do one search of their profile and you literally have to take a Silkwood shower and you're like, oh, right. You are so garbage. Everything about you is terrible. I would never even indulge you at a bar.
at a wedding, anywhere. I would literally probably hire a hitman on a friend who thought they would set me up with you. So no, like,
yeah, I'm never that bored. I'm never that drunk. Yeah.
Men have way too much access to women on the internet. Oh, in just in general, I wish we could have some little closed off version. I don't think that's possible.
I agree. I don't think that's possible at all. So your special is hilarious, but I read the LA Times piece and there was so much to unpack, and we're going to get to some of that in a second, but like, here's what I want to know, because you're literally one of my favorite comics of all time, not just like working now woman, but of all time. And so
thanks.
Before we talk about your work, do you set parameters for yourself when you're choosing material? Because you are dark and funny and silly all at the same time. So do you second guess, or do you not give a fuck on first time out if you choose a topic that you know is going to be controversial to some people? And we all know that just being on stage as a woman and deciding to be there is controversial. But like, do you set parameters? You're like, yeah, I think, how do I want to frame this? Or do you just go for it if you think it's funny?
I go for it, I guess. I don't sit there and go, oh, this is dark. Let me see if, you know, like, it's got to be something that kind of is bothering me that I want to try to break down. So I always just look at them as like joke ideas before they become jokes, or areas I want to go as like, you know, little puzzles that it's like, oh, this is interesting. Let me see if I can put all these pieces in place and get to it. So that's kind of how I look at stuff. And I try to do it in a way that interests me, that if I were in the audience, I would laugh. So that's how I get to the jokes I get to.
I'm going
to
echo Liz here and just repeat that you are an incredible, one of the greatest joke writers we have.
Oh gosh, thanks.
Our head writer thinks the same. And you also were the only woman in some writers' rooms for many, many years. So how did those days of being the only estrogen bag in the early days evolve? Wait, do you think it's evolved? I don't know. What do you think?
I do. Actually, from what I see, the writers' rooms are a lot more diverse and have different, you know, there's like funny people of every possible persuasion. You can amass an incredible writers' room just from picking different voices, you know? So it seems like a lot of the late night shows, and probably the daytime shows too, but they're less writer heavy, but they seem to have turned a corner and they get that now. That's what I've noticed. You know, I was the only woman a couple times, and the times I was, it changed later. So, you know, there's so many reasons to be insecure when you're in a writer's room, especially if it's your first job, that woman is just one of them. And maybe the imposter syndrome thing is part of being a woman or whatever. But I mean, I guess because I'd been a stand-up comic for so long, I was used to that dynamic. It wasn't shocking. I wasn't coming from a wholesome, good place. I was coming from mafia nightclubs. So I was used to men.
It's weird having been on both ends of it, having literally been the only woman in the room and I was the person in charge, to being the only woman in the room and I was reporting to a man, and both have their own sets of fuckery of like,
yeah,
snowflakiness being one when I was literally the boss, and them being like, I can't believe you didn't. And it was like, are you like sad that your joke didn't, like, just write another joke?
Oh my God, the temerity. When my jokes didn't get picked, I'd be like, oh, I suck. I got to write better. I would try to come up with an action plan to, you know, maximize my brain or something, and to actually go to the head writer and go, why didn't you pick this? That's insane. I would never do that. Never.
But also it was, to me, I felt like you're creating me as a mommy figure, not a person who is like skilled at understanding how to pick the right joke or punching up a good joke. You're literally like, but can we just talk about what? No, we can talk about what? What's going on? The joke goes on in like an hour and a half. Move on. Tomorrow's a new day. Come on. Wow.
Did you ever want to send them to their rooms? You want me to be your mommy? Go to your room right now.
I wanted to send them to their rooms, but I knew that if I had to go get them, I would have to enter the den of filth. It's a size of solitary confinement, a writer's room. It is writers' offices at comedy shows. And Lori, correct me if I'm wrong, are worse than like being sent into the hole. like on us.
They can be awful. Yeah.
They're tiny, opposite of creatively like inspiring. And it's just full of Funyuns and regret and like guys who don't get up early. So showering becomes unpart of their repertoire. It's wild, actually.
That I do think part of the diversity in writers' rooms is showers. Like, I think, there people are including that in their packets. I wash every day and I don't mind it.
It does feel like you can tell when there's not diversity because you'll hear a joke and you'll be like, so nobody that in any way references was around when you guys decided that was acceptable, huh?
Right. Nobody went, hey. Yeah, you can tell when there's not that.
Wow. I think that's how you tell a good show now too. It's like, oh, is mm-hmm. it really speaking? Especially shows that have any kind of like responding to the world or to the news elements to them.
Yeah.
Like the ones that feel the most relevant are the ones that have people on their staff who are most affected by the garbage that's happening because mm-hmm. they can write the darkest, funniest shit about what's happening to them. It's nothing better.
Yeah. And and as you said, they can also stop stuff that makes someone look kind of out of touch, which a lot of wealthy hosts could, you know, they could, if they choose, live lives where they are not in touch remotely with how the audience lives. So even if they're trying to be real, they're famous and they have, you know, meetings and people and assistants and stuff. And so if you have a few writers that are like, this plays a little bit this way, let's tweak it, you know, that's also a great thing too. It just keeps the host from, if I were a host, I would want that just to make sure, you know, we all have blind spots and we all have things where, you know, we're just not going to notice. And so you need people that would notice that.
Yeah. All right. We're going to pivot, Lori, because you're on an abortion podcast. It's the funniest abortion podcast, we'll have to say, like out there in the universe. So let's talk about comedy and abortion, because I don't give a fuck and I find many hilarious things about abortion. So tell us a little bit about, how do you talk about abortion in your life with people? And then how do you talk about abortion on stage? Is it different? And do you curb it? Do you say abortion? Do you say reproductive right? Like, how do you dive in?
Oh, I totally say abortion on stage. I try to treat it like it should be treated, just a normal thing that people do, you know, and if anything's weird about it, it's people's reaction to it, not the actual act itself. So that's kind of always how I've talked about it. When I was like in the 90s, when I was traveling, you know, in the South, I had a very quick abortion joke. I went in and I tied it to being Catholic. And then I got out really quickly and I went on to the next thing. And I wouldn't linger on it because I was like, I don't want people to realize what they just laughed at and to think about it. So I'd pop around, you know, go to another topic quickly. But I'd also feel like, what a victory. I got a laugh on an abortion joke in Chattanooga. That, you know, that's always dicey. But I talked about this on my special, but I got doxxed because, and Sean Hannity did a segment on me because I just told a dumb abortion joke on MSNBC because I was on the weekend that they leaked that they're going to overturn Roe.
I watched that episode when you mm-hmm. were on Amen. I watched it.
It's not a great joke. It's just a dumb little riff. And there was no reaction on Sunday night. And then MSNBC put it on Mediaite, and then that got grabbed by Steven Crowder, and then it went into this Facebook right wing, you know, fake TV show, whatever they do, and then Sean Hannity picked it up. But it was like the amount of vitriol just for joking about it, not even saying, oh, I've had one. I was sickened by that, and I've always admired anyone that would come forward and say that they've had one. That legislator, I think, in Arizona saying she needed one. Mm-hmm. I know the hate she must have gotten has been horrific, you know, and just for joking about it, it was ridiculous, you know, it was scary.
It seemed really scary.
Did you taken off guard?
Yeah. A lot of emails. Someone sent me a picture of my house. Then I later realized they got off Zillow, but I was like, was someone standing across? Like, and for a while I thought it was, you know, I don't know. It was just weird.
Did you, you know, find any new fans? It's some people say, love your work. Love your work.
Not really. And then I got some like, I'm a Democrat, but, they don't think it's funny. It's sacred. You're creating fodder for the right wing. No, we're supposed to be silly and whimsical about everything that we do and everything that happens to us and everything we're faced with. That's the human nature, is to find something funny about it. That's what we're all kind of looking for when we want laughs, you know? So yeah, that was another side that was, you know, beyond the Christians that were outraged.
We get those.
No, we get that all the time. Like, first of all, we have permission from the people who help us fundraise for our nonprofit. When somebody writes, and inevitably they always do, we don't like the way, just what you said. Why are you, I'm pro-choice. I was going to donate to you, but now I'm not. And we're like, you never were. Fuck you. Bye. Lose our number. Because it's just like, you're a liar.
Right.
And also,
yeah,
our whole thing is Democrats in action around this and kowtowing to terrible language around abortion and using that language and never self-examining how you really feel, but just wondering how it's going to affect you politically and selling all of us down the river of had abortions. They're the ones who I want to hold accountable more than anybody else. I know Steven Crowder's an asshole. We already know that, right? But Democrats who are pulling that bullshit on you, no and no. We got your back, friend.
Yeah, that whole safe but rare. Rare? No, just safe and easily available, please.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That stigmatizing language of the 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. Rare is how you order meat.
It's none of your business if it's rare. Talk to the people injecting their semen if you want it to be rare. You don't talk to the person receiving it.
Except the weenie garages are always the ones who get all the hate every single time. Never about person who can't park correctly or who left the engine running, that you all carbon monoxide poisoning.
God. Lori, you and your friend Jackie, also a friend of the show, have been doing a weekly pod called the Jackie and Lori Show since 2015. What a way to maintain a friendship. You really know how to friend. Why'd you guys decide that that's what you guys needed to do to build a friendship? Like every week? Every week.
I know. Yeah. Sometimes we're like, oh, we got nothing. We just, at the time when we started, it was mostly men doing podcasts and talking to other men. And it was men. And we thought, let's just do us and we won't have guests because it's a pain in the butt to book guests, as I'm sure you guys know. And
we have producers. You know,
we can. We just decided to book ourselves week after week. But we actually didn't know each other too well. And Liz can attest to this because during the 90s, they never put women on a show together. Sometimes clubs would space their female comics months apart. So like I would go to a club and I'd see 8x10s on the wall and I'd be like, there are other women doing this. I see it. I see their pictures, but I can't ever meet them. Why? Because of that, I didn't meet a lot of like my so-called contemporaries until we were in our 40s and we'd all, you know, moved to the same, you know, big city together. And so Jackie was one of those people. I knew she existed. We both started in the late 80s and we probably didn't meet until the early 2000s, you know?
We've just begun to scratch the surface. I'm going to just ask right on the air, when we start going out again and doing our shows, will you join us? Because you're so awesome.
I would love to. Every time Jackie tells me she's on one of your shows, I'm like, oh, I'm so jealous. So yes, please, let's do this.
Also, will you please come back because your special is incredible. I want to just talk more to you about, because we haven't even touched the surface of like harassment, what it means to be a woman walking the earth in comp. There's so much to talk about with you, but for the time being, I'm going to say, everybody, please, please, please go watch Lori's special. It is so friggin' hilarious. Cis woke grief slut.
Thank you.
Listen to the Jackie and Lori show and you're just great. We'll put all your socials in our show notes. So Lori Kilmartin, thank you for being a national treasure.
Oh, yes. You're welcome. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
That is the correct response. You're welcome.
Follow Lori on Twitter and Insta at AnnieLori16. Listen to the Jackie and Lori pod wherever you pod. And watch Cis Woke Grief Slut at Apple TV, YouTube, and a bunch of other places. You can find out all those places at LoriKilmartin.com. The link, of course, is in the bio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks again to Dr. Tracy Wheats. And be sure to support AAF.
Indeed. Did we make you smarter? Make you laugh today? Show us some love by liking, subscribing, and giving us a 5-star rating. Plus, stay connected with us on social media at Abortion Front across every single platform. With your help, we can get more people to learn about the assault on abortion access and have fun doing it. And if you haven't already, go sign our petition at aafront.org and ask the FDA to use their power to protect mifepristone.
Looking for where you might fit in to do some abortion activism?
We've got a 5-part activist training series, Operation Save Abortion, at operationsaveabortion.com. And while you're there, visit our super cool activist calendar, which is full of local and national actions and educational opportunities. This week, featured action is How to Bust Abortion Stigma Like a Boss, a virtual Repro comms workshop hosted by Resurge, Vecinas Feministas, and the Abortion Dream Team. Attendees of the interactive session will talk about how stigma works in our minds, societies, and pop culture, challenge our own biases, and learn how to create positive and affirming comms and messaging around abortion. It's on Tuesday, April 16th from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Zoom. Link is in our show notes.
And just a reminder that next week, Moji and I and the AAF squad will be in Minneapolis to celebrate another showing of the documentary about Abortion Access Front called No One Asked You. If you're in the Twin Cities, please come. It's a special, special weekend. The Saturday night screening is sold out, but the fundraiser for Abortion Access and party is not. You can get tickets for that, dance, drink, karaoke, all kinds of things at mspif.com. Also, tickets for the Sunday screening at 2 p.m. are available. Moji's going to be there. I'm going to be there. The team's going to be there. So come and join us. It's going to be a great night. Ticket links are also in the show notes. And we're off next week, but when we come back, we are celebrating our 100th episode of FBK, and the team is surprising us with all kinds of guests to come in and regale and wax on with funny anecdotes and stories. Moji and I do not know what's in store, and that means hilarity. So you want to join us for that.
So much hilarity. Also, join our Patreon. You'll support great content and get cool FBK merch and experiences. All pledges support this pod and all of our activism at Abortion Access Front. Pledge at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills. FBK is produced by Abortion Access Front.
And finally, we leave you with TLC's Seeking Sister Wives, Garrick Merrifield, a man showing you his whole ass when he reveals why he brings his lube to church.
A lot of the scriptures, the terms where it says he fills you with the Holy Ghost, it's actually a sexual term. It actually means like sperm going into like intimacy that way. And even scientifically, we've found that, you know, when a man and a woman become one and his sperm goes in the woman, that his DNA becomes part of her. It actually goes into her brain and she becomes one with him. But yet the woman can't transfer her DNA back to the man. So it like showed the proof of how Christ is with his church. Like he transfers to us, we don't transfer to him.
Feminist Buzzkills, the podcast from Abortion Access Front. New episodes drop Friday. When BS is popping, we pop off. And if you want to support our podcast and all the work of Abortion Access Front, like, subscribe, and join our Patreon at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills.